When it comes to maximizing time in the uplands, without fail, Onyx Hunt is my most valuable tool. From planning my next hunt through a new bird cover to navigating in the field, Onyx Hunt is truly with me wherever I go. With detailed mapping and satellite imagery, along with a multitude of map layers from land access to forestry and habitat information, and easy-to-use tools to mark, measure, and catalog important information, Onyx Hunt seamlessly integrates digital scouting with boots-on-the-ground time in the field. With offline mapping and Apple CarPlay integration, you are free to explore the wild landscapes our beloved upland birds inhabit. Planning your next move in the uplands begins with knowing where you stand, and for me, that starts and stops with Onyx Hunt. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com. This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. On this episode of the show, we talk forest and prairie grouse hunting with Dave Lessard from the Under 40 Yards YouTube channel. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 204. Welcome back to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast, everybody. Thank you for tuning in this week. We've got a great show coming up with Dave Lessard from the Under 40 Yards YouTube channel. We'll get to that in just a moment. Happy New Year, everybody. And thank you to Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast. Your continued support of the show is greatly appreciated. And new this week for Patreon patrons, got a sneak peek at a little video project I contributed on with Nick Adair of the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. He's launching a video series over at GDIY. And when he and the boys from the Southern Outdoorsman podcast were up at my cabin last year, feels weird to say that now, I guess, in the fall of 2022, we took one of the days we all went on a hunt together to help Nick out with the pilot episode of this series, so to speak. That has been finished, and it is viewable now for Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast and GDIY Podcast. That being one of the benefits that Patreon patrons of the show get, in addition to being eligible for monthly giveaways, of which I've got a winner to announce on today's show as well, discounts on things like Upland Institute and Gumleaf USA, bonus content like the video, and a little welcome gift pack for new patrons, can coolers, and Birdshot Podcast stickers. And this being the first episode in January, we do have a winner to announce of last month's giveaway, winner being Rich W., winner of the signed set of traditional side-by-side parts 1 and 2 books from author Doug Stewart, who we interviewed last month. So I will be connecting Rich with Doug, those books over his way. And we'll just remind you that if you are interested in contributing to the show above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for considering that. And another reminder to leave a rating, review, subscribe, follow the show. If you're new listening, any of those little things you can do, just take a moment and are very helpful to the Birdshot Podcast. So always appreciate that. And if you didn't catch this on the last episode, another reminder that Onyx Hunt, now available on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. Heard from a handful of listeners at least when I mentioned it on the last episode that they went ahead and tried it in their vehicle and said it was awesome. I have yet to do so in mine since I some days have Apple CarPlay and some days do not, depending on if the aftermarket stereo system and cable in my 2007 Toyota Sequoia want to work. So Have yet to try it myself, but have heard it's awesome. So if you have Apple CarPlay or Android Auto, and hopefully you got OnX. If you don't, you should do that. And if you need to get OnX, use the code BSP20 to save 20% on your subscription. Once you have it, go check it out on Apple CarPlay. All right, one last thing before we get to today's episode. I have been asked a bunch now in the last week or so, will I be at Pheasant Fest? And the answer is yes. I am very excited to be at Pheasant Fest. Looking forward to it. I will be there primarily on Upland Gun Company business. We will have a booth at the show. We are very excited about it as a company. This will be the biggest event we have been to yet. And again, exciting in our case because there are still many people that have yet to even have a chance to see the shotguns, and a whole bunch of folks will be able to do so at Pheasant Fest. So look for the Upland Gun Company booth at Pheasant Fest, and you will likely find me. If I'm not there, I may be over at the Onyx Hunt / Final Rise combo booth. Find one of those two places and you'll probably find me, and I'm looking forward to reconnecting with lots of familiar faces and meeting a bunch of new ones. So Pheasant Fest coming up next month in February. Looking forward to that. Hope to see you there. All right, let's get into the episode today. We have Dave Lessard from the Under 40 Yards YouTube channel. If you're like me, my local hunting seasons are now officially closed, today being January 12th, and I have been transitioning into the off season and dealing with a little bit of those post-season blues by watching some YouTube videos of other bird hunting adventures. And one of those people is Dave Lessard of the Under 40 Yards YouTube channel, who you will meet and learn a whole lot more about today if you're unfamiliar with him and his work. We talk a lot about rough grouse hunting. That's what Dave grew up doing. In the last couple of years, he has started to make a western prairie grouse hunt. So we talk a little bit about that. And towards the end of the show, the last 20 minutes or so, we briefly start talking about the YouTube channel a little bit and then get into some technical stuff regarding GoPros and cameras and some things that may not interest everybody out there listening. So just wanted to give you a heads up. That's about the last 20 minutes or so. I will say, and I think I mentioned in the show today, when I do talk about the GoPro and other stuff on the show, I get asked plenty of questions about it. So I know there are folks out there interested, but I know that's not the primary reason that everybody comes to listen to the Birdshot podcast, and I understand that. So just wanted to give you a heads up. That's what we tend to talk about towards the end of the show. So if you decide to tune out then, no big deal. You're just going to miss the giveaway for the free Upland Gun Company shotgun. Just kidding. No giveaways. You're not going to miss anything. And Dave and I will understand if you cut out before the end. But thanks for joining us today. With that said, let's welcome into the conversation and on to the Birdshot podcast from the Under 40 Yards YouTube channel, Dave Lessard. We're rolling, buddy. This is the Birdshot podcast, and we are joined today by Dave. Now, I didn't ask you this in the pre-call here, but is it Lessard?
That's right. Yeah. All right. You
just
got it right.
Just the way it looks.
Yep.
How are you tonight, buddy?
I'm doing great, Nick. Excellent. Great to be here.
Yeah. Pleasure to have you on. I gotta thank you. I have been dealing a little bit with the off-season blues, I guess you could say. I did sneak out hunting on Sunday, which was probably in all likely the optimist in me does not want to say officially, but it probably was my last hunt of the season. But I've been enjoying some of your YouTube videos of late.
All right, thank you. Yeah, I'm kind of facing the same situation this week, so
yeah,
here we go.
yeah. Well, before we get into all that, why don't you tell us just a little bit about who you are, where you're from, and the Under 40 Yards channel.
All right. My name is Dave Lessard, and I live in North Central Illinois, Rockford area. And I run a YouTube channel called Under 40 Yards. It's primarily upland hunting. It's been around about 8 or 10 years now almost. And started with a little Vizsla pup, and we kind of grew it into video after video. And, you know, now it's an addiction, sort of, just like hunting.
Yeah. The channel continues to evolve and stuff. And you have a professional skill set in video editing. Am I getting that right? I know we've chatted quite a bit over the years, but
I don't. I Strictly a hobby, actually. It started, I had a little bit of some things at work that we were doing to help with some training that I got involved with. Some it's kind of where the video editing started, but it's really just an interest. You know, I had two small kids and a camcorder, and you know, just started cutting up video, and it just evolves after that, and you just get better and better, and you know, try to increase your skill set every year.
Yeah, very cool. Well, yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that. And you know, last week you listened to my interview with Nick Martin, who is also somebody that is, he's putting some videos up on YouTube. And again, it's one of the things that personally I turn to a little bit this time of year, just to kind of live vicariously through some others. And it's cool. And there's more of it popping up. And I will say, every time I talk about with my guests on the show, I try not to mix too much of it in, like the whole GoPro thing, because it's not for everybody. That's not what everybody is out there doing. But I will say, I get quite a bit of questions and people curiously asking about that kind of gear setup and everything. So we'll definitely pick your brain. And I think I've said this before on the show, but I just sort of, my personal take on it is that the technology is only going to get better and better, both from a hardware perspective and the software side of things, as far as like cataloging and editing and putting this stuff together. So I kind of got over the hurdle of just, okay, I'm going to start capturing this, not knowing fully what I'm going to do with it. But you know, we all know how fast technology moves. I mean, 5-10 years from now, who knows what sort of software or something might be able to go back and sort of catalog some of these videos and these sides. Do you think about that at all, Dave?
I do. I mean, I've seen, you know, since the channel started, I started it in about, I think, 2014 officially, but I had been doing some video work before that, you know, just family stuff. And then the cameras have come so far just in the last 3 or 4 years, even, especially GoPro. You know, I started with a GoPro 3, and it was a good camera, but you know, the stabilization wasn't there.
Yep.
So, you know, everybody's watched plenty of older videos that, you know, you're a little head sick after you watch them because of the shake, but
they should put a motion sickness warning on that.
Exactly. Right. Now you can do some of that stuff in post. But you suffer some loss of the quality because it does a crop. Basically, it has to crop out. And YouTube itself has a stabilization system inside of it if you choose to use it. It's mostly awful, so I never use it. There's really no need to today with the modern GoPros. Their stabilization is so good.
Yeah,
it's really a game changer. It's to me, it's taking the hunting genre and just legitimized it to a certain degree because of that technology. Not only stabilization, but the horizon leveling.
Yes.
That's a key component to it.
Yeah, I do remember before I got my first, well, I had a GoPro 4. I remember talking to you about all this, and that I tried it once or twice. I actually got, I think, like one of the first birds I ever killed over Hartley on it. And I know I've told this story before, so I won't belabor it here, but that was just, you know, again, any sort of quick sudden movement or whatever, you know, it was very jarring, the footage and stuff. And then eventually somebody tipped me off, you know, 5-6 years later, the GoPro, I think 6 is what, that was the first one that you had with the stabilization. Is that correct?
Yeah, 6, 5 was actually the first one they came out with it. I waited a year. I typically wait every 3 models and then I'll invest. And I feel like that's a good spacing in general.
Yeah.
So the 6 was a little bit improved, and that's really where things started to change. But even using the 6 today compared, I use a 9 primarily now. It's, you know, it's frustrating, you know, because it's just not as good, but at the time it was excellent,
right?
You know, so it's just the sign of the times.
Just leaps and bound improvement. You just think back, you know, whether it's an iPhone or a GoPro or whatever it is, it's just this stuff goes, advances so fast. But yeah, so that being the case, and again, for capturing stuff like this in the field, you know, not everybody cares to, nor would ever consider having like a cameraman hanging over their shoulder. So because of that, right. you got all these cool moments that happened to yourself, it happened to you in the field. And of course we have our memories and we all think back fondly, and maybe some folks even keep a journal, but now you can kind of capture this stuff pretty easily. And that's the one thing that I've talked about, is like being able to run the camera with a few little tips and tricks so that it is not a total drag as far as like an experience of using it. You know, it's pretty seamless and I use it all the time. And because of that, you capture stuff. And as I've talked with Nick Adair a lot, like a lot of times you rewatch this stuff and it really shows how your actual recollection of the sequence of events is not always true when you watch that on the video. Do you have stuff like that happen quite a bit?
All the time.
Yeah. Isn't it crazy?
I like to say video is very honest, and yes. it's hard to fake. You can edit out your sloppy moments, right, and your misses. And I do that. I try to keep it as realistic as the hunt went. You know, I mean, everybody misses. I show the misses.
Yeah.
And, I don't show all of them, but you know, when you play back those moments, and you know, let's say you're hunting with a buddy and boy, you didn't realize you were as close to him as you were,
yeah,
in the action. And, of course, some people may comment on that, but when you're in the action, if you're putting a camera on your head and you're in that situation, it will really surprise you when you play it back and go, wow, I had no idea that that this person was this close, or that situation maybe wasn't as safe as I thought.
Yep.
But typically your instincts as a hunter, you're aware of your surroundings and at the time in the moment, it's really not a problem. You know, and the camera can make things look closer or worse than they are.
Yes.
Especially when you have a wide angle lens like on the GoPro. It may show someone that looks like they're in line with you, but in reality, there's lots of space between you. So it's not, it's honest in the sense of the playback, but it may not be honest in the perspective 100%.
Yeah.
So I try to convey that.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point to bring up. And actually, I noted that in one of your, I think it was in part one of the Montana Sharptail video.
Yes.
There was a shot there where you kind of commented, you know, for the safety police out there, this was
exactly.
And so like two separate things there. Yeah. I like the saying the camera's honest, especially when it comes to like sequence of events, like did the dog move before the bird, or right, what exactly happened there? And I've gained a lot of insight with that. But exactly like you said, and if you mess around behind the scenes at all with a GoPro and you lived a moment in real life, so you know what it looked like, and then you go and watch it on the GoPro, like you said, that wide angle, you could speak to this more than me, but I think it condenses the amount of visual information on the screen, so it makes everything look closer together than it actually was in real life. Is that how you would describe it?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And one thing is, in your mind, you may think, boy, that was perfect dog work or whatever, because it was just a great, maybe you made a nice shot and the setup was nice. You play it back and you realize, well, the dog wasn't as steady as I thought he was,
right,
or, yeah, or, you know, maybe his tail was flagging or something like that. And, you know, it kind of brings you back to reality because, you know, your brain remembers something different than what the camera sees a lot of times.
Yes. Yeah. And that's one of the bigger takeaways for me. And that was something that Nick and I talked about. I think it was on one of our bonus episodes recently, but I'm assuming it all has to do with sort of your heightened state of awareness, and like you've got a little shot of adrenaline, we got flushing birds, and you get that almost tunnel vision focus. But like you, I think it's cool to point out, like if you're a seasoned hunter and you've been doing it a lot, you are doing a lot instinctually, and you have an awareness of where the dog is, where your hunting partner is. So you're kind of going with your gut and your instincts, and you're just acting out of instinct really in that. And then, right, then when you watch it back, it's just really unique. But that tunnel vision, I think that heightened state of focus, that's what kind of like crosses the wires in your brain a little bit when you go back and try to recollect things. Like and this has been proven over and over again, as far as like, you know, eyewitness testimony in court and stuff, like eyewitnesses and your recollection of events is not all that reliable when it comes to a lot of this stuff. So it's kind of cool to see how that plays out in the hunts.
It is. A lot of times, you know, I think most of the times you're probably disappointed more than you are
right.
the other way, you know, just because you always want to remember, especially when you're hunting, you know, and you're in your best moment. This is your time.
Yeah.
But there are times where I thought, boy, that sequence wasn't very good. The dog work wasn't very good. And I go back and play it and realize that, you know, the camera saw the dog before my eyeballs and he actually did very well. And so it definitely goes both ways.
Right. But right. Yeah.
It changes the way you hunt a little bit because you think about things a little bit more. And I kind of think it's a good thing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I think Nick Adair said he was like sort of like, you know, game tape of you know, a football game or something. It's like, you know, you kind of watch this stuff and you get a little insight out of it. And obviously to each their own, you can kind of do with it what you will, but I got a lot of value out of it. And some of that visual stuff, just kind of knowing I've got those things saved, you know, certain, like, you know, my two dogs, seeing birds pointed and killed over them. It's just really, really cool to know that you'll kind of have that forever. So.
It's invaluable. I mean, you'll find it with your kids. I mean, I have just hundreds of videos of kids and over the years, it's just, you know, you can't replace that stuff. So it's, you know, for you right now, you're living in the best time because the equipment's way better than it was 10, 15 years ago. So
yeah, it's crazy. Just like, obviously I've got young kids, 1 and 4, and the, you know, my parents have a lot of pictures and stuff, but man, I can just scroll back through the past 2-3 years on my iPhone and like the videos and like the live moments that we all have now. It's just, it's incredible, really.
And it is.
It's like, it's just nothing, you know, cause you just, it's brand new technology one day. And then a week later you're like, oh yeah, that's how it works now.
Yeah.
Well, where did this whole obsession/addiction start for you, Dave? Let's go back to the beginning. What's the Dave origin story? And I ask you that, I'm gonna crack open a beer and pour one here. I don't always do this during the podcast, but being that the season is kind of over, this is kind of my toast to the hunting season here. So,
and we're both you know, rough grouse hunters, so it's indeed appropriate.
Yeah, exactly.
So my story started with the bird. You know, you kind of ask if it was a dog or the bird. It was for me, it was definitely the bird. And my connection to northern Wisconsin, my father grew up there, born and raised in the Hayward area.
Okay.
On the Chippewa flowage. My grandfather was a muskie fishing guide on the flowage. So my father grew up inside the resort where his grandmother also, she technically owned the business. And so once he graduated high school, he went into service and then moved to Illinois. And I grew up in Illinois, but obviously our connections up there are deep and I have a lot of family in that area. And so we spent, you know, all the time we could up there. My father ended up retiring from down here in Illinois, or escaping as he calls it, which I believe is accurate from Illinois. So, they built a place up there is where I go now. But we grew up, I grew up, I think my story is, I think, very similar to yours. You know, I've heard your story. I've been listening to since episode one. So, I've heard your story a few times. I may have missed a few in there, but sure. You know, it's got to be pretty close to every one of them. But cool. I grew up a partridge hunter like you, right?
Yeah, yes.
You know, a lot of two tracks. We walked and we drove. We did road hunting. We did. We didn't have dogs until a little bit later. So we were partridge hunters, and that's what my grandfather called them. I didn't even know they were called a grouse until I was probably, you know, 16, 17, honestly. Yep. It was just, it was never said. And the first time I heard it, I thought, what the hell are you talking about? You know, and my grandfather never uttered those words. You know, it was always partridge to him. So I think my dad first brought it up. So But we hunted up. I used to go with my dad, walk along with him. And in those days, he would, it just seemed like, you know, when you're a kid, 10 years old, a mile seems like 10 miles, right? When walk. So, you know, the way I remember it is we must have walked 40 miles a day. But obviously that wasn't true. But man, it sure seemed like it, you know, with your little legs. But yeah. I would just follow him. And I finally got my hunter's ed done when I was 13. I somehow missed the 12-year-old age. I don't know, the classes were full or something. So the first year I hunted was when I was 13. I carried a shotgun.
Okay.
And, you know, my first bird was sitting in a tree or sitting in a ditch. I remember one of the first ones I shot, you know, I had this old, my grandfather gifted me an old Remington Auto 12 gauge, full choke, fixed. And I just turned that bird inside out. You know, it was just
partridge slaughter.
It was just that bird was a bag of feathers when I got done with it. But it was at that shot, you know, you're just like, wow, this is incredible. And from there on out, we went every year. And typically we would go for like a week in October.
Yeah.
I had down here in Illinois, I had an uncle that, he had kind of a small kennel of German Shorthairs. He must have had, I say small, he probably had 8 or 10 dogs. And but he wasn't a professional breeder. He was just a bird hunter. And he took me out to preserve maybe when I was 11. It was before I could hunt. So I was just walking along with him and my father. And he put those two or three dogs on the ground. And the first time I saw a short hair point, I was like, what in the hell is that? I had never seen anything like it before. And it was just
probably the coolest thing you'd ever seen since the first time you saw a partridge.
Exactly. I mean, it was just like, what is that? I didn't know what they were doing. And then the whole sequence of events came and went. And I think we were hunting chucker. And, you know, the dog retrieved it. And I thought, wow. So,
yeah.
My uncle, his place was just down the street from us, about less than a mile away. And so I'd spent a lot of time over there with those dogs. And my parents were not dog people, and especially my mother. So my father grew up with Springers. They always had a Springer. And so he always kind of wanted a dog, but I think my mom was the block. And somehow they convinced my uncle convinced him to give me a short hair puppy when I was about 12.
Oh, wow.
12 or 13. So it was just the time I was starting to hunt. And that dog kind of changed everything, you know, as far as, you know, we didn't know what we were doing with it.
Right.
We had no idea how to train it. I don't know that my uncle was a good trainer either, but we certainly didn't know what we were doing. So we made every mistake in the book. The dog, I mean, looking back on it at the time, you don't think you're making a mistake.
Right.
But, you know, knowing what I know now, I look back and go, my God, what was going on there? You know?
Yeah.
But the natural ability of the dog was, you know, undeniable. And he turned into kind of a neighborhood menace, you know. We had some neighbors with some chickens, and you know, he kind of exterminated a good portion of the guy's chickens, and he's a German dog, so he killed everything in sight, everything he saw, possum, squirrel,
not cats.
Cat, I don't know that he ever got a cat. You know, maybe they're a little too quick for him, but. Yeah. He would bring fox back to the house and plop him down right on the patio and look at me.
Man.
Just anything he could get his hands on. So he was just a stone cold killer, you know?
Yeah.
But loved people, you know, loved people, and hated animals and fireworks. He used to eat fireworks and bottle rockets, and he was crazy, you know, just a crazy dog.
Oh, man. That's funny.
He was not a very good grouse dog, I'll say that, but we didn't use him a whole lot because his recall was non-existent, and those are really the days before e-collars.
No GPS collar. Yeah.
And, you know, you're talking, you know, in the mid-80s, and it was kind of a mess when you took him out to the woods. So he only made a few trips with us. So we went back to partridge hunting.
Well, you know, I've heard that before, and I think, I think growing up partridge hunting, as you and I tend to call it, you know, without a dog, basically. Yeah. And I've heard this from numerous people, and I think even when I got my first bird dog, there's a little friction between sort of the way you successfully go about partridge hunting versus hunting ruffed grouse with a dog.
Yeah,
and exactly. Yeah, it's you gotta approach things differently, and it doesn't work the same, exactly the same way.
You do. I mean, if I'm being honest, and someone will, I'm sure, maybe have a problem with this, but if I wanted to kill more grouse, I would leave the dog in the truck and just walk a two track. I mean, we probably killed more birds that with that method. Especially, I have an uncle, my dad's brother, that was just an exceptional shot. I mean, I still to this day have not hunted with anybody that could shoot like he could. He would have the bird on the ground before I shouldered my gun. And so to him, to hunt with a dog, he kind of says, why? You know, we're
right.
We're so successful doing it this way. And, you know, it is different. But it's kind of your pursuit of perfection with the dog. To me, it takes it to a different level because, yeah, you're going to miss opportunities. He's going to bump birds, especially rough grouse. But when it comes to woodcock, it opens up in a whole new world.
Right.
And obviously, all the other species of prairie birds, to do it without a dog is just foolish. But
yeah.
Rough grouse, we could have a debate, you know, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But to me, and I'm sure you'll agree, and everybody in the dog world has the same sentiment, the dogs create the drive to get your butt going and get out there. You know, you just look at him and you're doing it for him and you, and it just gives you more motivation. It's easier to sit at home when you don't have a dog staring at you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the difference with hunting rough grouse with a dog to me, but
yeah. And I would echo that, especially if you are, you know, if you are a dogless hunter and you are setting out to shoot a rough grouse, no matter where it is, be it on the ground, in a tree, on the wing, et cetera, you know, that if you all of a sudden you get your first bird dog, there's going to be a little dissonance there between sort of your birds in the bag with and without the dog. But the long, like what the way it's played out for me, and again, like nobody needs any convincing, like sort of the element and the appeal that the bird dogs add to the hunt. Like it's just totally not the same looking back on the way I used to do it. But I've learned so much more about the birds just because you encounter so many more, you find so many more because the dogs are finding them more. So like the long term upside potential of hunting with a dog has just, you know, erased any of those kinds of thoughts. And then the other thing is, like, there's just, I mean, no partridge bagged is ever as cool or as memorable as a dog that has the perfect bird dog hunter interaction, you know. Dog points it, you get the flush, you drop. I mean, that's the pinnacle, whether it's a pointy dog or a flushing dog. It's just when you have all three of those things in tandem and the end result is a bird in the bag or not a bird in the bag, you know, it could still be pretty damn memorable. The bird flying away. I mean, that's what we're all chasing, I think.
Yeah. That memory with the dog is going to stick with you longer than when I was walking a two track by myself or with my brother or my uncle and we took a bird. Now, you know, there's scenarios that, you know, funny things happen in the woods, right? All the time. And whether you're with a dog or not, funny things happen that you always remember. I mean, we have, you know, just a lot of those types of stories, but
yeah.
But being with that dog, it just makes it different.
Yeah. Well, yeah, a couple things on the dogless grouse hunting, because actually I don't get asked all the time, but we have brought it up a little bit, and there are people that, you know, not everybody out there has a dog, and there are people that listen to the show without dogs, and it's been suggested to, hey, you should do an episode on hunting grouse without a dog. And
yeah,
I mean, a lot of the stuff we talk about does apply, but I will ask you, actually, I was going to say, talking about memories, I've got, oddly vivid memories from my first grouse hunt. And I remember the first grouse that ever flushed. We were, my dad, my uncle, and I think my cousin were walking down a two track, just like kind of you're describing. We're just walking down, mm-hmm. and there was a little balsam tree, you know, right in front of us. And as grouse hunt long enough, and this will happen to you, there's a bird right under this balsam tree, and it explodes at all of our feet, you know, and flies straight down the trail. And I think my dad might have maybe raised his gun, did not fire a shot. And I just remember being the little kid without a gun, like, oh, why didn't you shoot? Why didn't you? Why didn't, you know, it's like, it's so easy. Yeah. And my dad just kind of shrugged his shoulders, like, like the same reason nobody else got a shot, because that's what rough grouse do.
Exactly. Except for my uncle, you know, he was the guy that had the bird on the ground. And when when I was younger, he would let me shoot sometimes. Right. And he would say, you know, shoot, what do you do? You know, what do you do? The biggest enemy in rough grouse hunting is hesitation. And in every new hunter that I take out, whether it's family members or friends, first time they do it, you know, you hear the explosion and you just freeze. And, you know, sometimes you just got to sling lead. It only takes one pellet to bring down a grouse. You know, I always say they're hard to hit, but easy to kill.
Right.
And it doesn't take a lot to bring the bird down to the ground. And you just got to put lead in the air. But the great thing about rough grouse to me is it's one of the few upland birds that you can easily hunt without a dog.
Yeah.
It's the least amount of equipment, I feel like, of any upland bird that there is. Really, you just need a shotgun, decent pair of shoes or boots, and that's it.
Orange cap, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, and an orange cap. You know, we had the cheap game hide vests or whatever.
Yep.
You don't need a lot, just a box of shells, and you can just go and have some fun. But there's not a lot of birds that you can do that with, you know.
Yeah, like you said, you walk those two tracks, and you'll flush one, or you'll see one standing in the trail. I mean, you can get close to grouse without a dog, and that is one of the things that's appealing and made it very accessible to me when I was younger.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
you as well.
Yeah,
yeah.
I probably wouldn't be doing it, you know, otherwise. But
yeah,
you know, who knows?
What are your top tip? Anything come to mind? If you were to, yeah, the dog's taken away, you had to go out grouse hunting tomorrow, what would you do?
Let's see. I would get the, at least a skeet choke or cylinder.
Yeah.
I would shoot, 7.5s or 8s. I like a little bit quicker shell. You know, we used to shoot, you know, I shoot mostly 12 gauge. So, we used to shoot, you know, the 13, 30 ounce and a quarters a lot, which is really, it's too much. You don't really need that.
But
I like a little,
I
like ounce and an eighth. 1250s are pretty good load for grouse, because we're crossing that with woodcock too. And, you know, woodcock, you're just going to knock the hell out of them with anything more than that. So,
right. Yeah. That's a, yeah. Ton of pellets.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's what I would recommend.
But if you're when it comes to like actually, you know, hitting that two track or like, what are you doing?
I'm just walking, picking a side,
yep.
and I'm looking for, you know, the cover is not going to be, it's something that's kind of learned. So if you're just starting out, you know, ideally find someone that knows
sure.
how to do it, that can mentor you to a certain degree. But it won't take long for you to get an eye for the cover. You know, you just, the term, it looks birdy or it looks grousey, just kind of comes naturally as you kind of learn the cover that they're in.
Yep.
And just be patient, you know, expect to be humiliated.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It, don't expect success. In fact, the first 10 times you go out, you're probably not going to come back with anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took me, I think I was 14 by the time I first shot one on the wing, or maybe 14 or 15. It's probably my second or third season.
Yeah.
And I had that dog, that short hair of ours with us. And he really wasn't involved with the whole scene. He was just there. I shot the bird, and it kind of came out of a spruce up above. And I knocked it into a little slough water. And I thought, oh, perfect. We got the dog here to go get it. And he just stood there and looked at me. So he
Mean
ended
you
up.
hadn't worked on like blind water retrieves
Yeah. No,
yet?
that wasn't in the training regime schedule back then. So we had to fish it out. But it's a little bit of luck. It's a little bit of just reaction, and it's snap shooting. So you can go and go to the range and shoot and shoot some trap or skeet, and that's certainly not going to hurt you. But it becomes instinctual. The shooting is different. Like if I'm shooting, pheasant, I'm shooting in a different way. It's a little more deliberate. With rough grouse, there's definitely technique to improve your skills, but it's mostly your brain and your two eyeballs working with you. So,
You're just you're feeling the pressure to do things quickly, and that can be a recipe for disaster unless you practice. And I mean, it's again, I one of my buddies, I he's much older than I, and he's one of my grouse hunting mentors. He's been doing it for a long time, decades, and he's like, he still gets unsettled by a grouse or misses an easy shot. And I'm just like, I always joke, like, I never know whether to be like, to sort of say, okay, it still happens to Scott, don't worry about it, or man, like, am I never going to get any better at the, like, this is going to be like this for the next 30 years, but it never gets any less fun, so.
It's everybody has off years too. I mean, the last 2 years, I feel like my shooting has really suffered for whatever reason, but it just comes and goes. I've had those years. I've been hunting. This was actually my 35th year, believe it or not, hunting
Wow,
grouse.
that's so cool.
I can remember some of those years in college, in the early 90s, or sorry, the late 90s, mid 90s, and it was some of those cycle down years that, man, we didn't see any birds. I mean, I remember going 1 year. I don't think I only had a 3-day weekend because of school. I think I fired the gun once. It was really down. So if you're lucky enough to hit top of the cycle, that's a whole debate in its own, I think. But there is something to it. There's definitely something to the cycle, the 10-year cycle. So, and I know you've discussed this a million times, so I won't rehash it. But if you can conveniently get into it at the height, maybe you're gonna stick with it a little bit longer. Who knows?
I mean, the populations do fluctuate, and yeah, there absolutely is, at least historically, there was some rhythm to it. Where that stands today, it seems to be getting a little bit less clear, but
I would totally agree. I remember the 98, 99 years was for the books, from my point of view. 2010 was also, 9 and 10 were also pretty good. But this last cycle, I don't know. I don't know if I really saw it. It was a little more murky. But
Well, I mean, I would say, and this is kind somewhat anecdotal, but the last two seasons were good to great, I would say, for me, and we're technically beyond where we should be for the peak of the cycle. And as we were leading up to, it's usually 0 and 9 years that end in 0 or 9 are kind of around the peak, but even it's not exact. Like, you don't mark your calendar for 2030 now and say, I'm going to go grouse hunting in 2030. It's just, that's not really how it works, but it's been interesting, and of course I pay more attention to it now.
Absolutely. I mean, that's another thing that the dogs bring is the level of study that you do. And podcasts like yours are really an eye opener too. So these are great resources that didn't exist when, I was in my 20s. You could read some books or whatever, but it's not quite the same,
The our access information is certainly unprecedented, and that will only continue to evolve. So it's pretty cool. And again, tying in the video side of things is I mean, imagine being somebody that wants to take up grouse hunting tomorrow, between all of the old books and everything that did exist before. You've got that. You've got podcasts. You can go listen to conversations of people talk about grouse hunting. And as my buddy Ben Bredigan from Onyx, he always likes to say, go look up search rough grouse hunting in whatever state you want to go and just go look at some of the cover that these people, I mean, you can actually get a visual of where these birds are. So a lot of, resources for the new hunter or the person that wants to get back into it or just simply learn more. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's very accessible. I think back even, you know, I had some friends that hunted back like in grade school, but I was definitely the weirdo, you know, if you want to look at it that way, like, you know, what is partridge hunting? You know, I would go on these trips and my buddies, they just, their families weren't into it. Right. Yeah. I grew up in the far north suburbs of Chicago. It wasn't, you know, it's a small town, but it was still not a super rural area, but not an urban area.
Sure.
But it just wasn't part of the culture like it is in maybe where you live in Duluth or in northern Wisconsin where we go. It's just more part of the life. So, you know, it's those people around you that have a huge impact on, on what you do. And if you're just not, you don't have that group of people around you, you're going to do it maybe a little bit less than you would. So,
yeah,
but at least today, you know, the information being available, it does kind of take out some of that, some of those barriers, I feel like, because, you know, there's more of a community, even though we don't all know each other, personally, we're all interacting with each other today.
Yeah. 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 People, you can network a lot easier, get in contact with people.
Right.
And I just thinking back, I mean, so much of what I did and whether this was just, you know, somewhat being sort of younger and you just go about things a little bit differently at that stage in life. But I mean, so much of what I did was trial and error. Whereas like now I'm so much more strategic. And I mean, just take a look at a tool like OnX, the access to information you have there as far as like, okay, where can I hunt? And then beyond, you know, it started with where can I hunt, where's the public land. Now you've got forestry data and you've got information in there that you can be so much more strategic. Whereas when I was younger, we were driving around in areas that, you know, I generally knew to be outside of the city and forested land. And like, I was looking for any kind of a two track or something that looked halfway decent that didn't say no hunting, but I had no idea. I didn't know if it was public or private. I mean, I didn't know anything as long as it didn't say, you know, I wouldn't walk past a no trespassing sign. But other than that, it's like, okay, I'll walk down here and see if we can find anything. And as you were pointing out earlier, just you flush more and more grouse, you begin to start to, your brain just naturally sort of associates whatever that habitat looked like right there. The next time you walk through a patch of cover like that, you're like, okay, that looks birdie, you know, like you just connect those dots sort of organically, I guess.
Yeah. OnX is, it's a wonderful tool. I can't say enough good things about it. But there is kind of a catch 22, like you just said, is when I first got OnX, you know, this is going back a few years now, there was a few instances of disappointment because I pulled up in a spot that I thought was public. I had been hunting for years. And it turns out, wow, I had no idea. You know, we used to use the gazetteer all the time. I'm sure you did years ago.
Yep.
We had a gazetteer in every vehicle. And then my dad had the plot books that were a little more detailed and we would look at those, but you know, you're looking at those in the kitchen counter. And then you jump in the truck and you get in the car. And even if you have it with you, you really don't know where the hell you are anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You're kind of like, this might be good or this might not be good. You know, OnX doesn't lie to you and it says, you know, you're on public or you're not.
You're
and,
right. Man, here.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I had to give up a few roads because now I know.
Yeah.
So you know, it can burn you a little bit too, but
yeah. And that's actually for people that hunt in Minnesota and or Wisconsin, that's a slight distinction in the states where Wisconsin, you cannot hunt private. I mean, if it's private land, even if it's not posted, you cannot hunt it. That's not the case in Minnesota, as far as I understand, unless this has changed. But in the northern part of Minnesota, essentially the non-agricultural part, if it's in the forested region of the state and something is not posted, you can hunt it even if it's private land. So,
interesting.
I wouldn't necessarily recommend people take that and try to go hunt private land. I mean, I don't think I hunted. I probably have not hunted unposted private land in Minnesota in since I knew what I was doing. Like, yeah, like now right, that I know yeah. where I am, like I'm on public land all the time. Right, I probably right. still wouldn't go hunt private land, but I always knew reading that regulation in the Minnesota regs, it's kind of oddly written, to be honest, but
right.
just to throw that out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, some of the details too in Wisconsin are, you know, they have forest crop or managed forest crop. So right. you're putting your private land into a tax break. And by doing that, you're not allowed to post it. It's yep. open for hunting. Now the plat books don't always show that. Mm-hmm. And then years ago, people would post it anyway, yep. because who's going to enforce it, right? So a guy's got a couple hundred acres of prime whitetail cover that he's got in forest crop, and he hangs no trespassing signs on it.
Yep.
Technically that's illegal, but it's so hard to research it and find out. You'd really have to, right. you know, go through a lot of effort to point that out. But, you know, it'd be a 3-hour argument on the side of the road with a DNR warden or something. But,
yep.
But so we used to see that all the time, because we would get the plat book that would show that, and you kind of know the guys were posting their forest crop land.
Right. Yep. Right. Yeah. That's a cool, I mean, I think in general, probably Onyx, it kind of holds everybody accountable. Like you got, yep. I would imagine you have less of that now, or cause it, yeah, we would see that too, where, you know, something's public and there's no trespassing signs cause people are trying to protect their deer. What, but now you can, you know, now with a tool like Onyx, you can just clearly see that's, I feel like I don't run into that as much as I used to. So
yeah,
that could yeah. could be a benefit there, but
yeah, I wonder if that's the reason. Yeah.
Right. Right. It's just people understand like they're going to get called out on it at some point.
But, exactly.
Yeah. But the last thing I just wanted to comment on the, again, hunting grouse without a dog. If yeah. I were to give anybody advice, I would pretty much echo a lot of what you said. And I just like if I had a strategy, if you could call it that, it was, I would go slow. I mean, you can't really go too yeah. slow yeah. down one of those two tracks. And you said, be patient. So I was kind of nodding yeah. my head when you yeah. said that. And you'll hear this a lot. If you do enough reading, it's that people will tell you, you know, walk 10 yards and stop, or walk 100 yards and stop. And that's never a bad thing. I have a hard time being that patient. I can't stand yeah. standing still. So I wouldn't necessarily, I didn't have a pattern of like walking and stopping, but I would try to go slow. And the reasoning behind that is the slower you go, the higher the odds that you're going to unsettle the rough grouse and make the bird make the first move. That's how I always thought about it. And a lot of times it'll be a subtle move, but they might take a step, or they might start to cluck, or in yeah. some way they might give away their position if you're don't appear to be a predator that's just kind of strolling through, where in that case they're going to be much more likely to just hold tight, sit still, let you go past. So the slower you go, the better your chances you have of that. And the grouse's first move, which would be a smart one, might be to just burst into flight and take off. And then good luck, yeah. you know, it's up to you yeah. at that point. But sometimes they'll take a couple steps or cluck or make some kind of a noise. And yeah. if you can get on them, I mean, you need every advantage you can if you don't have the dog. So,
right. That is excellent advice. Especially on a dry day.
Yeah.
You're going to hear those leaves, and it's amazing how much noise their feet will make
yeah.
in the cover on the ground. And a lot of times you can even hear that driving, you know, driving slow down a
yep.
fire lane.
Yep.
I've hundreds of times I've heard a bird out my window.
Yep.
And I stop, and maybe I see him, and then I unload and try to get a shot.
Yep.
It's pretty accessible as far as upland hunting goes, you know.
Yep,
absolutely. And that's going to help you learn the cover too. Just right. driving through the woods. I mean, you're always going to drive a lot when you're upland hunting. Mm-hmm. It's no different for rough grouse. And the more you drive, you're going to see birds and then kind of learn what the cover looks like, where you have seen them. But sometimes on those cycle up years, you see them everywhere.
Yep.
I mean, I remember years we're shooting them out of the maples.
Yep.
And, you know, just sugar maples, which was, you never see them in a normal yeah, year.
That's
that
not
area.
my it's not going to make the top 10 spot list of stand to sugar
exactly.
maples, but like
right,
exactly
right.
like you're saying on an up year, they could be there. But yeah, that's a good point. You know, never, if you're in, just because you're in the truck, especially if you're just starting out, I mean, never consider that wasted time or downtime. I mean, it was, heck, for me, it was a game to the, as soon as I saw the first grouse standing on a forest road, I remember my dad and uncle pointing that. I mean, from that point forward, I mean, my sole goal riding in the passenger seat was to try to spot a grouse. And I mean, I got pretty good at it to the point where I still, I mean, I can't help but try to spot them on the ground. Like I just, I get a kick out of that.
I'm sure you're like me, and come October, when you see that bird on the, on the road, you, everybody in the car or the truck loses their mind. But if you see that same bird in the spring, everyone goes, "Ah, oh, cool, grouse."
Yeah, grouse, yeah.
But as soon as the season starts, everybody loses their mind, you know. the brake dust is flying off your wheels, you know, you're skidding to a stop, you're unloading, you're going to try to chase it. It's just the excitement of the whole thing.
It's
wonderful.
Gearing up for your next hunt? Check out Ugly Dog Hunting Company for all your dog supply needs. Ugly Dog Hunting carries a full line of products for your bird dog and even some for you. Whether you're looking for dog collars, GPS tracking devices, kennels, beds, leads, training equipment, or first aid supplies, Ugly Dog Hunting carries it and a whole lot more. New owner of the company and friend of the Birdshot podcast, Mike Nadusky, loves to remind me that while I do hunt with pretty dogs, every dog can be an ugly dog. Check out the entire selection of gear for you and your bird dog at uglydoghunting.com. For many upland hunters, along with their passion for dogs, birds, and the places we chase them, comes a passion for shotguns. Upland Gun Company specializes in customizing shotguns for the upland bird hunter, imported from Italy and shipped direct to an FFL near you. Select from one of their side-by-side or over-under shotgun platforms and customize the fit, function, and aesthetics to your liking. Design and build your next upland hunting shotgun with Upland Gun Company today. Visit uplandguncompany.com. Yeah, there was some shots in your opening scene on the Autumn Blaze number 9.
Yeah,
you got some good shots of grouse on the side of the road and stuff. And so
that
grouse silhouette, you know, wherever it's standing on the side, wherever it is. Actually, on the last hunt that I went on Sunday, out on snowshoes, last day of the Minnesota season, right as I got back to my truck, it was dark. It was like 4:45, so sunset 4:30, season's over. And just as I'm getting back to my truck, I hear wings, and I look, and sure enough, a grouse hopped up into a mature aspen tree, filling up on buds before the sun goes down, and just all I could see was that dark silhouette against the, you know, a darkening sky. I mean, it's just, I mean, that that fires you up.
It's the classic silhouette, and I'm sure you've shot at or wanted to shoot at a fern or two in your life. So.
Oh yeah, the old stick grouse. Yep,
right.
Been duped many times.
There's a lot of things that look like grouse in October,
especially when you want to see them that bad.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man. Well, we may come back to grouse a little bit, but we've been chatting here for good. I do want to talk to you about, and it's a good segue because we're kind of talking about, sort of hinting at new hunters and what people might do. Well, something that you've done new for the first time in the last couple of years is gone out west to chase sharptails after chasing ruffed grouse for, you know, 30 plus years. Talk to me a little bit about your first couple trips out west and chasing sharptails. What'd you expect? What did you find? And obviously you went back for more, so.
Right. Yeah. I honestly have probably your podcast to credit for it, at least the interest. You know, you kind of know that it's out there or whatever, you see magazine articles, but you know, for some reason, you know, you're focused on the game that you normally hunt, and everybody gets in that zone and you just feel like, ah, it's a little bit out of reach, maybe it's too far or whatever. But so last year we went to 2021, I should say, we took a trip to North Dakota, my buddy and I, Tom, and
is that the guy that you went to Montana with this year too?
Yep, same guy.
Okay,
so we took a short trip. He travels a lot, so we had kind of a short schedule in 2021, so we really only hunted like 2.5 days in North Dakota. And so I scouted and I reached out to a few people on Instagram and asked some advice on areas, and it was pretty wide open as far as where you want to go. It's basically Western North Dakota is the key, as everybody knows. We ended up kind of in the southwest area of the state, and it kind of revolved around the Airbnb that I could find. You know, there's not that many.
No, there aren't. I've looked.
There's just not many places to stay. And I was surprised calling up there that some of the hotels had a no pet policy. I was surprised, you know, because I had heard how much accessibility was in North Dakota, and we had a tough time kind of finding a hotel that would take a dog or allow you to have one. So we really didn't want to leave them in the truck. But we found this house, and it was a good time. I mean, we learned a lot. I did as much scouting as I could. I probably scouted for 3 months, you know, over the summer.
E-scouting,
yep. Using Onyx, dropping pins everywhere, looking at the plots program. Unfortunately, that was the year that they came out with the electronic posting.
Yep.
And we really struggled, Nick, to find a place to go in the area we were.
There was lots of electronically posted.
Yes, there was a few plots places that we knew we could go. So those were the obvious choices. And then those places that weren't posted, you know, my hope was we'll pull up and there won't be a sign and it won't be e-posted. But man, I tell you, every good looking field, every single one of them was posted. So we drove a lot, and we just drove all over that area. We didn't go out to the national grasslands. We were probably an hour away from there. We probably should have went that way, but that was the drought. In hindsight, that was the drought year. So it was, I know it was way grazed over. Conditions were tough, but we did find some birds, and we shot our first sharptail. So that was the whole point of the mission, was to experience it. Exactly. So this year, you know, you kind of realize, you're like, boy, Montana is only 150 miles more. Really, it's really not that much further from where we were. So we just kept going a little ways, and the whole Montana experience for us was much better because of the accessibility. The block management properties were just incredible. Just the amount of places that you could go, and then the care that they took of the land. Of the landowners and the state land that's available, the BLM that's available. It was just a lot more plentiful. So to me, it was an easier hunt in Montana because of those reasons. And then you didn't have the, you know, North Dakota has a 7-day season thing, and you had to choose your dates. Not that I'm going to be there more than that, but you know, it just adds another element to the setup and your planning.
And the Montana's it's a one-time fee. You get the whole season basically, right?
Right. Yeah. You don't have to worry about all these particulars or, you know, be a waterfowl guy with all these weird dates and stuff, you know?
Yeah. And then if you want to get a wild hare and you want to go back, or which in North Dakota, you get 2 7-day periods, but it's a little added complexity there. Yeah,
it is. Yeah. It's, I'm probably, you know, complicating it too much, but it does add a little bit of element there. Yeah. But if you know people, you know, if you're comfortable knocking on doors in North Dakota, it would have been fantastic, you know. But when we're only there for 2 days, 2.5 days, you know, you get a conversation with a landowner, which would be terrific. You know, that might chew up 2 hours, you know, some days. So we were really just trying to hit it hard, our objectives, and get it done. So, So Montana was a little bit nicer trip for us.
Yeah.
And the birds this year were just incredible numbers. So, everywhere we went, we saw birds, but we weren't successful everywhere, but
the sentiment from folks was, good to very good year for sharptails and huns too. How about huns? Did you guys get into huns?
Man, we just, you know, we were limited to 2 dogs, and so our main objective is let's focus on sharpies. That's why we came. Yep. And then we're going to treat huns as incidental, kind of like I do woodcock in a way in the woods.
Yep.
And by the time we filled our bag with sharpies, you know, our dogs are burned out. So we only found a couple of coveys of huns, and we killed, I think we only killed one. And it was a little frustrating, only because, you know, we picked a few spots that I thought you know, they had edges of ag and some CRP ground, and it looked like it would be good cover, but we just didn't come across any coveys that reliably. So we were only there 4 days,
yeah.
4 days of hunting. So
that goes by pretty, quick.
It does go by very, very quick. You know, you have a morning hunt and an afternoon hunt, essentially, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have maybe three. If you're lucky, you might get four walks in, maybe.
What but time typically, of – you were there in September, right?
Yeah.
What time of the month?
Around the 18th, 20th.
Okay. So it wasn't the very first part of the season that was super hot in Montana.
Right. Yeah. The first couple days we were there, it still hit about 80.
Yeah.
And then it cooled off the second 2 days. So we had a nice cold front. But yeah, I saw the brutal heat the couple of weeks before us.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of thankful that we chose the week we did. But, you know, the bad news is a lot of the BMAs had already been covered quite a bit by a lot of hunters.
Sure.
Because you got to fill out those tags.
Yeah.
So you kind of know how many people sort of have been in there, you know, just by the stack on the sign-in box. But it didn't seem to hurt anything. You know, we went to some that had a lot of sign-ins, and we went to some that didn't have any, and it seemed like there was the same amount of birds. So they weren't pressured by the hunters as much as I thought they would have been.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear kind of your comments about the hunt. I mean, the listeners will have probably heard me. Like, one of these years I'll probably have to just say, all right, I'm going to take 2 days and I'm just going to hunt hunts. Cause I always do the same thing. It's like, all right, you know, here's how the day's going to go. We're going to go out and we're going to chase sharp tails. And if things go according to plan, we might have a limit and then we'll focus on huns later. And for one reason or another, whether it's heat or missed shots or just tougher hunting, it just never seems to play out that way.
Everything sounds good when you plan.
Yes. Yeah. Over a beer the night before.
Right. In July, it was like, it was perfect. You know, we're going to do this and it's going to be this. And then, you know, everything changes when your feet are on the ground. So, but you know, with two dogs, my advice would be have more dog power, but you know, on the flip side, you can do it with limited dog power. And, you know, we had my buddy's dog was a lab. So we had my short hair in his lab and that's it. And obviously my short hair, he's doing, you know, 90% of the footwork. And even with that one dog, we were able to fill our limits fairly easily. You know, we didn't really have to walk that much either. You know, I walked a lot less than I thought we'd have to.
Yeah. That's saying something. Yeah.
But had we had more dogs, we would have focused on those huns later in the day, and I would have put more miles on my feet too. But you know, you're not going to walk a field without your dog. At least that's my feeling.
Right,
so
right.
If they were tired, we were kind of done. And if we had our Sharpies, we were satisfied for the day. So,
I kind of found myself smiling and nodding at one of the days where you guys did fill the bags and you're kind of narrating in the video, just saying, you know, kicking back and having one of the, and I think I even wrote down, prairie tailgating on my little notepad here. I mean, it's like you commented on it. It's like, it's something about, it's the it's early, you know, it's early in the hunting season. So you're not in mid season form, you know, like super grind mode. There's something about going out for a walk, putting a few birds in the bag and then kicking back to some beautiful September weather. You guys are grilling Sharpie tacos there. I mean,
it's terrific.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
And I'll give it for the sharp tail tacos. I got to give a shout out to Andy Taylor of Steel Fork Kennels. He had posted something about that's the way he prepares them. And I saw his post shortly before we went on our trip. And we packed up some taco gear and off we went. I'm like, they were terrific.
Is that because I've had sharp tail tacos too, and that was kind of like something that I sort of inherited from some of the people that I went with. Is there anything special to it? Because whatever you guys were doing in that video, I was like, it just looked so good. And I like tacos. I like Mexican food. I mean, give me a taco and a couple beers. Like I'm a pretty happy guy, but it looked damn good.
Yeah. I think the avocado kind of pushed them over
that
the edge.
That looked like a key ingredient.
Yeah. There was a really great grocery store where we're staying that just had a lot of fresh ingredients. So we were just piling them in.
Yeah, I love that.
I mean, we just stuffed ourselves, you know. Like I said in the video, I think we cooked probably six or seven birds.
Nothing like a well-earned meal at that point.
It was terrific. But yeah, you're right about the tailgating. Just that's the thing too, is and this is a bad thing with video, because you always feel like you're in a hurry. You're always, you know, to a certain degree, you're trying to get the shot, right? And so that's part of the hunt, and it's always in your mind. You really have to just slow down and shut up and just relax. I mean, that's my advice for any hunting now, but especially out west. It was like, man, make sure you have that last hour before the sun goes down just to sit back and enjoy it, you know. I don't like to hunt all the way up to sunset anyways, you know, because I got to clean birds or whatever in the dark. I don't prefer to do that. So I kind of like that last hour of the day just to kind of chill out and have a beer and, you know.
Yeah, there was another part too where it may have been, it was your buddy Tom was sort of, you were recording him as he was recapping the hunt, which is, it's just a natural thing. You know, you go out for a walk with your buddies, you get back to the truck and you're breaking things down, and he was making like arm gestures and like, you know, and
It's my favorite part.
I'm smiling ear to ear, because that is, I mean, that is the stuff that like my buddy Ted Summer, and like he, we just, that's what we get into, you know, like that is the most fun part about it. Like somebody's
It is.
telling a story like that. So and it's not like you want to have a camera in someone's face for all of that for a whole trip, but I just thought that one moment was really cool.
I really liked that. He was you know, I think his family enjoyed it too, to make fun of him a little bit too. But I will say thank you to Ted. He gave me some good advice too the
That's
last
cool.
couple years on Sharp Tail. So he was pretty helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah, and what was the your buddy Tom, the gun was given to him by his dad, and the gun was like made the year he was born or something cool like that.
It's an old Wingmaster. His dad just passed away 2 years ago, kind of unexpectedly. And you know, so Tom inherited a lot of guns, and that was one of them. So you know, he pulled it out. I thought, well, you know, 30-inch choke, full choke,
Let it
fixed
rip.
choke. Maybe not the best prairie gun, but you know, he's pretty accurate. Tom's a pretty good shot. So
That was apparent in the video.
yeah, he made it work. He's always been a pretty good shot. So
Yeah, that's really good. And you he's mentioned what he's one of your high school buddies.
yeah, we've known each other for forever, since maybe freshman sophomore year of high school. So we've kind of sort of been hunting ever since. He was kind of in a waterfowl for quite a few years, and that's why he had the labs. But he's been more into upland, I'd say, the last, you know, 5, 10 years now.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, not everybody has that luxury, depending on kind of how and when you find your way into hunting. But yeah, if you've got old buddies like that, I mean, it's just cool. One buddy of mine, I've known him since kindergarten. I mean, that was the best man at his wedding, and we still grouse hunt together. Now we get out once or twice a season. I went up to his place once this year, but a lot of memories going back. He's going back to the days of, I know I've said this before, when we literally used to ride our mountain bikes around with wrist rockets around Duluth. And we weren't very successful, but we could find them. We could find them, but I don't think I ever killed one with a wrist rocket. I was close.
That'd be something. Yeah, man, I had about every wrist rocket they made, I think, you know.
God, those things were sweet though.
I mean, the Ace Hardware down the street sold them. They had a whole rack of wrist rockets, and I would go in there and just stare at them.
Gosh, I mean, yeah, they can be dangerous though. I
Absolutely.
never thought about the danger when I was a young kid shooting that thing.
Yeah.
But
I mean,
now
how
I
many?
think about giving it to one of my sons, I'm just like, geez, that's, I don't know.
Yeah, we had a pretty big yard, so I would just stay away from the house when I was a kid, you know, and shoot it away from the house. But you know, maybe it's a little different now with a smaller yard. You might break a window or two.
That's funny. I did write down too, was just since we're kind of laughing here, I wrote down a direct quote from you in your video, which was, "No, How the hell did I miss that one? Just said no bird hunter ever, right?
Yeah. It's the most repeated phrase there is in the uplands. I mean, some of those shots, it's like, did I shoot right through it? What is there a hole in my pattern? What is going on? You know, I mean, I've had just hundreds of times like that. It doesn't matter what bird it is, like woodcock, grouse, sharptail, you know, what the heck is going on? Was there salt loaded in that thing? Or, you know, and it was heavy. It had something in it, but I don't know if it was lead, you know? So,
yeah, I love it. I know I've had at least one person, this is just coming to me. This was when we were younger, a buddy of mine said that he said he shot and missed a grouse, and the guy that he was hunting with an older guy, and the guy that he was hunting with said it must have been a dud shell. And I think it's one of those things where at the time I literally took him at his word, but thinking back, I'm like, that must have just been a guy trying to make him feel better about it.
Right, right.
Oh man.
Yeah, I mean, it can happen. I used to load my own, so I used to shoot Trap League for quite a few years, right. and load it. And obviously, you'll have some in that case where the BBs just kind of roll out of the barrel. But
I have heard
it's
that.
Pretty, it's tough to use that excuse when everybody heard it go bang and the auto loader cycled and everything. Right. Oh boy, I can't cover this up.
Right. Yep. Well, so 2 years of hunting sharptails. If you had any advice to give, any sort of like, you know, top like keys that have sort of led to success for you, because I mean I saw that some of the cover in your video this year. I mean you can, it's more subtle maybe than the grouse woods, but you can really pick up on what that cover looks like pretty quick. I feel like
I mean we in 2021 we had really no idea, but the number one tool, again, is going to be Onyx. It's honestly, it wouldn't have been a trip without it. You know, there's other resources that you could find these properties. They just package it so nice. Mm-hmm. And that's, if you're not using it, especially on a first time trip, you know, you're probably wasting your time, but pulling up to the property and, as a bird hunter, you kind of have an idea of what it should look like anyway, to a certain degree.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of guesswork because, you know, this whole, the depth of the grass, is it below your shin? Is it, you know, some of the cover we were in
too
turned
thin,
out to be
too thick,
you know, we found pheasants, and then, you know, and I kind of know what pheasant cover looks like. And I know on Tyler's podcast, he always says, you know, if it looks like pheasant cover, it probably is, you know? So you kind of quickly, you can at least eliminate the pheasant cover and look elsewhere. But what really surprised me was the stuff that looked like there was almost no cover still held birds.
Yep.
You know, I was like, how can there be a bird? There is nothing here. And I was just amazed that the diversity that those birds will live in.
Yep.
It was really surprising to me.
Yep.
And then they also did the opposite. You know, we were expecting pheasant. There's a couple scenes like that in the video where we're expecting to see a rooster or a hen come out of there and a sharptail pops out. And it's like, what the hell?
Yep.
You know, so you're just kind of shaking your head sometimes, but you know, it's all part of the experience and learning. And, you know, eventually you're going to hit that 80-20 rule and you're going to look for that 80% cover and you're just going to exploit it. You know, there's still going to be birds in that 20% cover, but, you know, you're going to kind of learn what that 80% looks like pretty quick.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That's a good way to put it. And I mean, you could take a step back and just kind of, these are native birds. They've been here a long, long time. Like they figured out how to use this stuff and they're going to use every piece of it to their advantage when they need to. But like you said, when you pointed out, like that's, as bird hunters, that's kind of what we're doing. We're sort of high grading, you know, we're looking for concentrations of birds in specific habitat. And then you're trying to repeat that pattern over and over again. That's what
exactly.
We do.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Another surprising thing was the meadow larks and how much scent was on birds.
Yeah.
I was amazed. You know,
a lot of points on those
all the time. Yep. And it fooled my short hair Sawyer, you know, I don't know, countless times. It's like, I was just shocked that they provided that much scent for him to point. It was just a surprise, you know, cause they get up and we're like, what the hell is that thing?
Yep.
You know, and then you kind of realize, I think that was a meadow lark, you know, because you kind of hear, you hear about them, but you don't really expect a dog to point one. But obviously, that's not the case.
And isn't it weird? Like sometimes, I don't know if it was the first year. I think it probably was the first year. My dog Hartley, he was the only one I had at the time, just went. I mean, he pointed so many meadowlarks. I was like, I was, you know, what in the heck? Like, what are these things, you know? And then you figure it out. But it's weird sometimes, like, if the meadowlark is, if it's, let's say it's a little bit windy and the meadowlark is just far enough away, or maybe the way the light is, you know, you're like, was that a sharp tail? Oh, it was a meadow.
Exactly.
You know, it can be kind of confusing. I mean, I never to the point where I was taking a shot at a meadowlark or anything, but it can just kind of, your heart kind of skips a beat when you see that bird get up at times.
Yep.
And like you said, there's a lot of them out there.
I would say we saw them in every field.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we saw some fields, we didn't see any sharpies at all, but we saw meadowlarks everywhere we went, you know? So it was like, man, these things are just abundant. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. I had a guy reach out to me one time. He was suggesting that he lives in an area where there's not a lot of wild birds, but they have meadowlarks, and he's kind of like got a lot of training in on meadowlarks, and he was
would be great.
Yeah, suggesting like that they could be used as a tool. But I would wonder, I don't remember getting into this with him, but if you did that too much, then all of a sudden you go out to North Dakota, and then are you encouraging your dog to point every dang one of those things? I don't know.
But. True. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, we have some around here where I live, but nothing like I saw out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're getting close here. I want to just, let's talk under 40 yards a little bit. Like, I think we maybe sort of glazed over it at the beginning, but like, what was the inspiration for starting it? And then how has your enjoyment, and cause it's, you know, it's a hobby, like you said, but what's the channel's evolved and it's getting better and better.
Oh, thanks, man. Well, it started, what I consider my first bird dog, even though I had that short hair when I was a kid, he ended up getting killed by a car when he was, I think, 7, maybe, just because he was a wild man. You know, and we didn't have good control on him. But so fast forward through college, I didn't have a dog. I got married, a young family. We didn't have a dog. My wife was always a dog person. And growing up, she always had dogs. And so she was working on me for a few years. And I thought, well, if we're going to get a dog, it has to be a bird dog of some sort. And I had a friend that sort of, he had like a half Vizsla, half lab, I think it was. It was an unusual mixture, but I had hunted behind it. And I kind of liked its mannerisms, even though it wasn't a purebred Vizsla. It definitely had that blood in it. And so I got curious about the breed, and it turns out where I live in the Rockford area, there's a nationally known Vizsla breeder here. And so we made a phone call one day, and we went to visit. I took our two little girls with us, and they had two litters of puppies on the ground. They were already spoken for, of course, but we walked in to meet him in his kennel and discuss things. And I remember him telling me the price and I was shocked because I'm from a world of, you know, I got my short hair for free from my uncle. I know a guy that got one for $400. You know, I knew that wasn't realistic going to a breeder, you know, but he's, you know, at the time he said, well, these are $2,000. And I said, holy cow, you know, that's a lot of money. And that's because that particular litter was from, the sire was the winningest Vizsla of all time, the most titled Vizsla in the country. And so they were getting a premium for those. But I said, well, what's your normal puppy cost? He's like, you know, I think it was $1,500 at the time. And so we started discussing, and he had all these dogs were spoken for. And he said, are you going to hunt with them? I said, well, of course I'm going to hunt with them. It was kind of this weird question to me. But a lot of Vizsla owners, and I didn't know this at the time, were, you know, a good portion are not hunters. And that's true of any breed, but I think particularly this breed, maybe a little bit more than others. And so when he heard that, he literally crossed someone's name off the list and put mine on.
No kidding.
And I thought, holy cow, I just came here to look at the dog and get a feel for it. And here I'm on the list. Yeah. And And so here's the dog. And I think at the time they were only, 5 weeks old or something. So we came back 3 weeks later and we had the dog. And all right, I shouldn't say that. We ended up getting on the next litter that he had upcoming. So we got him later in the spring. So that's kind of what started, because I had this dog. I wanted to do the training as correctly as I could, because I knew my childhood short hair was not done properly or at all. And I didn't want to experience that. Right. So the first thing we did is we put a fence around our yard. Yeah. Something I didn't have when I was a kid. I got to keep the dog contained more than anything. And we're going to do it the right way. So, the cost of the dog is small compared to everything else, right? That fence cost me way more than the dog did. So, if anyone's looking at getting a dog, it's like the price of the dog is nothing compared to, what you're going to get yourself
into. I got a fence now that I didn't have before I got Bird Dog. So I know.
Right. Exactly. And I hated fences. Like I don't like them, but we had to get one. So, so I started using my cell phone to record things everybody does.
Yep.
And the guy that I got the visa from, he also ran a put and take right there on his property. So he had a couple hundred acres of land, and you could buy birds from him right there and learn a little bit from him. He had a pigeon coop, so you could train with his birds and you could run year round if you wanted to. So for a new dog guy, it was perfect for me. I mean, he's less than an hour away. I would drive over there every weekend and I'd run the dog and I just kind of start recording things with my phone. And then we go on hunts. I'd buy a few birds and we'd hunt out there. And I just use my cell phone and I shot one handed for a while, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Trying to do this ridiculous thing with my phone, so I could show my buddies.
Sure.
Look what we did, and I'm holding my phone and I'm shooting, I'm left-handed shot and I'm shooting with my left hand and I'm knocking birds. I got pretty good at shooting one-handed. So it kind of went from there, and I took the videos off the phone and I started. I've always been into computers. I'm an engineer by trade and I'm a software engineer. So I'm always into computers anyway. So I started learning video editing and it just kind of progressed. And, I thought, well, maybe we should put some of this on YouTube. So I started putting it just for friends and families. I'd send them a private link, just because the platform works good for sharing video. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I didn't put anything published, and at the time it wasn't branded under 40 yards. So I started thinking about, what could I call it? And, under 40 yards comes to mind because I shot trap for so many years. And if you're a shotgun guy, you're typically working under 40 yards. Yep. And that's your sweet spot, your range. So I thought it sounded kind of cool for a channel. So I branded it that and then just started kind of running with it. And, my buddies kind of got involved for a while and Tom still is, and we just have fun with it. And you just kind of, you've seen the YouTube video quality just get better and better. Yep. I think at the time there wasn't a lot out there, and I will give some credit, and I know the Heller brothers have been on your show many times.
Yep.
And their video that the Consummate Sportsman did, JB, back in the day, was like the eye opener for grouse hunting for me. I was like,
yeah,
somebody did a grouse video. And I know you've seen this video.
Yep.
Nick, I'm sure you've seen it 100 times, but that video was like, wow.
Yeah.
I need to do a grouse video, cause at that time I was just doing the put and take stuff.
Right.
And where I live, there are no wild birds pretty much. So you're stuck with put and take. So when I saw that video, I thought, man, I gotta try this. So I monkeyed around with
call
some
that
cheap...
a classic at this point.
It is. It's it's a fantastic one. I still watch it. I watched it, I don't know, a few months ago again,
but,
I monkeyed around with cheap cameras too, for a while, like some GoPro knockoffs, because I was too cheap to buy one. They were still, $400 or $300. Right. Like, holy cow, I got to give $300 for this thing. And so I buy some knockoff thing for $50 and it was total piece of junk. And so
meanwhile,
I would recommend,
you got $2,000 dogs and you're putting up fences.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I'm like, what am I doing playing around with this? You know, the computer you're editing on is worth a lot of money. And,
right.
You know, here I am mucking around with a stupid camera that the battery life was like 10 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
So I finally got that GoPro was the difference. And to this day, I still think GoPro's is probably the best choice. Although there's definitely a lot better choices now than there was some years ago.
Yeah.
It's kind of a love-hate relationship with GoPro and me, but
yep. And I know you and I have talked about that a lot, and I've heard it from others.
Yeah.
And I will say, after having the 4 and then jumping in, my next one was the 9. I think I was expecting like almost a flawless experience, and it was not like there are glitches, things will happen, you'll lose a video. And I mean, I'm sort of like, again, it's just, they're packing a lot of technology into a tiny little camera that needs to be waterproof. And I mean, they're doing so much with these cameras. Like it just, you get
that's
it.
Exactly.
But,
right.
They're not perfect, but yeah.
You're asking a lot out of that little device.
Yeah.
And for the most part, you know, I learned my way around its quirks, and it's been pretty reliable for me.
Yep.
Especially the 9, because they have that feature, the hindsight feature, which is a game changer for me, because as an upland hunter in the past, if anyone's tried this, I'm sure there is somebody in the audience, you're always recording because you never know what's going to happen.
Correct.
So what happens at the end of the day is you have just, I would come home from a grouse trip with 200 gig of video. And you have to cut all of that down to a 10-minute video.
Yep.
You spend all your time cutting and editing. And that is the single biggest roadblock to taking videos is what do you do with it when you
actually
have it.
Doing something with it. Yep.
Yeah. And even with the hindsight feature, still the same problem. It's just less of a problem.
Correct.
So, you know, I know a lot of people, a lot of my friends have bought GoPros and they wear it for a couple seasons and it ends up in a drawer because what am I going to do with all this footage? That's the hard part. Honestly, shooting is the easy part.
Yes.
Editing is where you're going to spend your time. And if you want to get better at it, it just takes more time to get better at it. And it's going to get frustrating. And that, if you do it too much, you're going to burn yourself out too. So
I'd really
try to pace myself and not overdo the amount of, you know, don't take it too seriously. But do it enough to keep your passion kind of going and you won't get burned out. Cause there's, you know, a lot of channels have come and gone over the years and I know what happens. It's like, man, it's a lot of work. And if you do it too much, you're just like, man, I don't want to go through that again. So,
yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, the one thing that I try to, again, we talked about it here too, is like, whether or not you have any interest in this at all, like you don't have to have the end goal in mind that, hey, I'm going to have a YouTube channel. I'm going to put this stuff up there.
Yeah.
I mean, like I'm capturing stuff and I'm still working out my system, but this year I decided I'm just kind of buying external hard drives. We got pretty good economical, like solid state hard drives. And you put stuff on there, you can edit from those drives, which I have not tried yet, but that was a big selling point for me was, okay, now I don't have to move stuff around. Like I've got a 2022 hunting season external hard drive that I just dumped everything on. And maybe I won't go in there for 10 years, but then 10 years from now I could go in there and, oh my gosh, remember this hunt in North Dakota?
Exactly.
And, you know, like just, I don't know. It's just there. Like it's, I guess it's something that I decided to start dabbling in and others have. And like we talked about before, I mean, how far away are we from us having like a contact lens that just records everything we're looking at anyway? You know, like that's kind of what I'm thinking is like.
And choosing what you want from it.
Right. Yeah.
I think
so.
But yeah, file management is a key in video editing. And, you know, the GoPro is just one aspect for me. Now I also carry a mirrorless camera on my person as well. So a lot of the B-roll and things like you see on my channel, I'm shooting with a mirrorless interchangeable lens camera.
Yep.
So that adds a whole other, you know, if you think a GoPro is expensive,
right.
You know, you can get yourself in some big trouble with the mirrorless systems. But, you know, the one I use is I think that probably the best value out there in my opinion, but that technology is getting better and better by the minute as well.
Right.
But it just gives that, you know, a little bit more immersive story than only the POV GoPro can
Correct.
Give you, yep. right? It's just, you're going to get some of that. To me, it's just more emotional, I think, you know,
yep.
if
yep.
that's kind of a silly
yeah,
word
gives
to
you
use.
More, but. Gives you more of the feels, more of the vibe. And I will say, like,
yeah.
that's kind of the one thing that I think has prevented me from doing a whole, I've taken some clips and I've shared my clips a little bit, but I look at a video like what you're doing and I just really appreciate how you kind of set the stage with some of that B-roll. And you yeah. know, that's like, I guess I'm just sort of speaking in generalities here, like from my assessment, but like, that's like filmmaking 101, you know, you do a little
right.
B-roll,
yep.
set the stage, then you jump into the action. But I just look at that and be like, that's, you know, that's a well done video. And I don't really want to do necessarily anything less than that. Now I'm kind of putting up a
yeah.
barrier in my mind because you got to start somewhere.
Yes,
you didn't.
You do, yeah,
Autumn
yeah.
Blaze number 9 was not your first video. You know, it's
no,
you're
no.
getting better and better at it because you're working at it. So
right, right. I 100% agree. It's just you just can't. It's just like you're hunting, right? You
yes.
want to do better at your craft. And a new PC. Like I invested in a new PC last month, and it's so much better than my previous machine. You know, it's like when you upgrade your hardware.
Yeah.
And as a software guy, you know, I do this for a living. Why I waited, I think I probably waited a year or two too long on my old machine, but a good PC just makes life so much easier. Editing big files. And if you're going to get into 4K, you know, you're going to have another hurdles.
Yep.
More hurdles to cross.
Huge
you're gonna
files,
need more storage.
Yeah.
You're gonna have huge files. So I still don't shoot in 4K. I don't.
Are you still doing 2.7K?
Yeah, on the GoPro I do 2.7, but I still render everything out in 1080 because I use the 2.7 so I can have a little bit of zoom if
yep.
I need it
yep.
and not lose the quality. So yep. you're already halfway there, Nick. With
well,
your
yeah, and I got those
and,
tips from you and stuff. And we were talking frame
yeah.
and like the frame rate thing. That's an interesting one because it's important
yeah.
for upland hunting because you get that slow mo and these birds fly fast,
right.
and so the more frame
yeah.
rate. But if you get up to 120 or the frame rate will really increase your file size as well, just like jumping up
it
in
will.
Resolution. So,
and it'll increase your exposure and your ISO. So
yeah.
I typically shoot in 60 frames. That's where
okay.
I limit it. You can get good slow-mo with 60 frames. So if you're rendering out in 30 frames, for example, you know, a 60 frame is, you can get a 50 look smooth, but you can really
okay.
go down to like a 30% and still get a smooth slow motion that, you know, you're kicking out 15 or 18 frames a second or whatever.
So any of the slow-mo shots I see in your videos were done at 60?
Were filmed in 60
okay.
and probably cut to like, you know, 30%.
Okay.
So you're talking, you know, 17, 18 frames is probably what they're playing back at.
Okay.
So if you start getting below 15 frames per second,
choppy.
You know, that it's going to get choppy
yeah.
and sometimes you can't avoid that.
Sure.
And that's, and a lot of times it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to, you know, be a detriment, but oftentimes I made the same mistakes when I was first starting. I would want like a 10% slow-mo, right? So
yeah.
I wanted as slow as possible. Well, the frame rate, you know, there's not enough information there to make it look good.
Yeah.
And you end up making it look worse the slower you go. So, you know, it's just one of those things that you learn.
You play around
and
with
I think,
it. Yep.
Yeah. And I think 60 frames is a good compromise because if you shoot at 120 frames, the sensor has to use more ISO to get the exposure right because the shutter is just running faster.
Mm.
So it's going to change the way if you're shooting in low light, for example, like in the evening
yep.
in the woods, it can get pretty dark.
You
in
get
the
a
woods.
Lot of low light shots in the woods. Yep.
Exactly.
And a lot of that is like some of the best hunting too, towards the end of the day.
Right.
Like that,
yeah. Right. So even at 60 frames, I get a lot of kind of weird ghosting with the GoPro.
Okay.
But if I were running 120 frames, it's going to be even worse. So, you know, there's a compromise. If you shoot 30 frames, you're good, but you're just not going to be able to slow it down and
right.
give those nice slow-mo replays, you
right.
know, that everybody kind of likes to see,
yep.
you know?
Yep. Yeah. It's so cool to play something in real time, you know, just to give you the sense of like, holy cow, that happened fast. Yeah. You know, and then you slow it down and you give it that look and you can maybe see where the bird's coming out of, you know, I love that.
Right.
I just learned something though. That's good to know. I pretty much have shot in 120, like 1080p 120. I was using looping mode a lot this year. I will, I'm going to make a note of that and play around with 60.
That's a good mode. Try 60 and maybe it works better in low light in those evening hunts for you.
And based on what you're saying, like I might, you know, I just was making the general assumption, oh, I get 120, I'll get better slow-mo, but maybe I won't even notice it that much. So,
yeah, I don't know that you will. 120 will definitely give you better if you really want that. But you know, you're using more space too, as you know, you're using more battery, the whole thing gets just more damaging to your time, I guess.
Yes. I'll warn listeners in the intro to the show that towards the end we get pretty technical. But I know some people will be interested. But
might be four of them.
Yeah, exactly. What's your gear setup? We've kind of covered a lot of it, but just basically in the field recording, and this has come up, it came up with Nick. We talked about the external battery pack. I got that recommendation from you, but just walk us through it real quick.
Sure. So I wear I'm shooting my POV with a GoPro 9. Yep. I'll probably next year go with the 12 when it comes out. Okay. Like I said, I go every 3.
Yep.
I have an external battery pack that I wear on my headgear. So I do everything head mount.
Yep.
I've tried chest mount. I don't like that viewpoint. It, you know, you're obstructed most of the time with the gun or your chest turns away from your face. You don't even see the shot. So to me, chest mount is, you know, I think it's good for skiing or something like that, but for
biking maybe.
Or right. Whatever. Exactly. Yeah. But it's not good for hunting. So the head mount is the best. Like I say, I have an external pack and it's basically taped to my headgear and it's in the back. So, and the reason for that is I've tried, you know, the long cord. I think that you run one from your vest all the way up to your hat. The only reason I don't is because it gets tangled on some trees sometimes.
Yep.
And a lot of times if I'm shooting my B-roll with my big camera, I want to quickly take off my GoPro because I just have this, I don't like to have it on my head when I'm shooting.
I'm totally with you. Yeah.
I just don't like to have it sitting there when I'm doing like a vlog type, you know, thing. So I want to be able to quickly get it on and off. And then on my side, I'm carrying my mirrorless camera and I shoot a Micro Four Thirds format camera. So it's much more compact than like a big full frame camera. And typically they have very good stabilization built in where full frame cameras typically do not. And for video, Micro Four Thirds, if anybody knows anything about cameras, they'll recognize that they're a little bit better for video. You know, it's a 3-hour debate with anybody, but for me, it's, I don't have to carry a backpack full of equipment that's so big if I was going to shoot full frame. So I shoot Micro Four Thirds and it has all the lens options that I need to do the job. And it's pretty good on battery life. And I can fit it in my vest pockets. So that's the key. And also carry a couple of lenses with me if I want to do some more tight shots or, you know, bigger aperture type lens for some artsy looking shots, you know.
On the GoPro side of things, external battery pack, do you have a 10,000 milliamp or whatever? What do you run?
It's, I'm actually running a 6,000, which I like because it's light enough where I don't really know that it's there too much.
Yeah,
because
you got yours up on your head. Yeah, yeah.
Right. The problem with the 6,000s now is that you almost can't find them. I think they most of them start at 10,000 because really the cell phones that people use these to charge with, their batteries are getting so big that these external packs are growing with them.
Sure,
in capacity. So typically, you know, your cell phone has a 5,000 milliamp battery. You want two charges out of it with an external pack.
Yeah.
So they're selling a 10,000 all the time. And I have a tough time finding a 6,000. So mine's pretty old. I've had that same pack for I bet 5 years
they
now.
Were, I mean, they are, you know, they don't seem to go bad as much as you charge them and
great.
Use them. It's, yeah. Yep.
I have an older one. It's even older. It's probably closer to 10 years old and it's still working. You know?
And so you're using a GoPro 9. Would you say you essentially, you're getting basically all day or all hunt battery on that thing?
Yep.
Yeah.
I never run out of battery.
Yeah. I had somebody ask me, they sent me a message today on Instagram saying they were looking at the 10 because that's what I had linked to. And they were like, should I get the 20? And I just said, no. Very rarely, do I hunt for, I'm not hunting 8 hours. You know, I would say most days,
My
actual hunt time is probably 4 hours or less. I have hunted longer than that, but I never have battery trouble. And I just, what I told this individual is you probably would be better off buying 2 10,000 packs than 120 just so you could have one charging and one. I mean, if you want to, I got three of these things now. I bought them for different purposes and they just come in really handy outside of this whole GoPro thing. But I mean,
inexpensive.
When you simply look at the cost of one extra GoPro battery, it just becomes a no brainer. For what we're doing, I mean, if you're using, many people use GoPros on a surfboard or something, you don't want to have a battery pack, but for what we're doing, it just makes too much sense to use that external pack.
The most difficult part, I'm sure you know, is the routing of the cable and getting the right 90 degree basically USB fittings or adapters to make the cabling work out, because GoPro doesn't, they didn't really think about us.
Correct.
I don't think when they designed that camera. So you have to do a little monkeying and experimenting with these adapters and getting the cabling right. But once you do, I never worry. The only time I worry about battery is if I forgot to plug in my external and the next day I go to hunt and I go, I forgot to plug it in. But outside of that, never have trouble. Even in the cold weather, it's limited. It, it degrades some, but it's still plenty.
Plenty of power.
So 10,000 will take you easily.
Right.
Easily all day. You know.
What do you edit on at home? Not necessarily the PC, a good high power PC, obviously, but software. What do you edit with?
I use DaVinci Resolve.
Okay.
It's I've used quite a few over the years, but Resolve to me is the best option out there. They have a free version that, and this is, it competes with Adobe Premiere. Yeah. It's at the same level, but they have much better price point and pricing that you can get and not be fixed with the monthly payment that Adobe wants.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the biggest key. So Resolve to me is the best out there, in my opinion.
But, okay.
So
cool, man. Well, tell us where we can go to watch Under 40 Yards on YouTube. That's where it's all at, right?
It's on YouTube. I'm also on Instagram. If you want to follow along there, I've got, I'm getting more into photography in the last couple of years. So you'll see, some photography there that I enjoy doing, and I'm using the same mirrorless camera that I'm videoing with. But, I really enjoy the stills aspect too, because you can, for one, it's much easier. I don't want to offend anybody, but taking stills is easier than doing video. So, if you want a quick upload, to do it right, obviously I'm not at a skill level that's anywhere near these guys that are out there. But if you want to get some pretty good content, photos are good, but Instagram's really trying to move towards a video platform more and more, but I still enjoy the photography aspect of the platform. So, to me, the video's for YouTube and other spaces, but
just with the aspect for it. I get hung up on that all the time. It's like, I got these, got these cool videos and it's like, well, Instagram kind of wants them upright, like a cell phone. To the point where even GoPros, they increase the image sensor on the 11 now. So you can kind of crop and make it for a cell phone. It's ridiculous, but I get it.
I end up upscaling my reels because, they're 1080, but in the other direction. So now your height is 1920. So you're going to have to upscale, unless you're shooting in 4K, then you can crop it and not lose any quality. But, that just takes a lot of effort. But I do like the reel format. It's kind of fun because I like making them because they're, you know, you can do them pretty quickly. You know, I don't have to spend too much time. And I also do that with Resolve. I don't use the Instagram app to do that. So
I was wondering that. I assumed that was a possibility. That's a rabbit hole I have yet to go down and
yeah.
I'm thinking about, but yeah, it's good to know. Yeah.
I get frustrated with the little screen and right. trying to use their tooling on there. Right. It's not great. So.
Well, the two English setters have decided that this podcast needs to end. I don't know, you know, you know how dogs are. They get in their head, they're up pacing around, and Rose has the squeaky toy. So I suppose we've chatted long enough, Dave. I really do appreciate it. It was fun to connect on this, and I will no doubt keep picking your brain from time to time about camera stuff and bird hunting, but I appreciate you taking some time to come on and chat with us here on the Bird Chat Podcast.
Nick, it was a great time. I mean, always a pleasure to talk to you, and especially a fellow grouse hunter. You know, it's there's no way I'm going to say no.
Well, right back at you, buddy. I appreciate it. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Hang on for just a second. That does it for this episode of the Bird Chat Podcast. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Onyx Hunt is the number one hunting GPS app. Join millions of other hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. Onyx Hunt shows you nationwide public and private land boundaries. They've got topographic and 3D maps. You can track your route, location, and elevation profile. You can save maps for offline use and take Onyx Hunt with you wherever you go. The most comprehensive hunting tool you'll own. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your next Onyx Hunt subscription. Know where you stand with Onyx.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gun Dog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.